Hello there, my name is Sagar Baroshi.
And I'm John Ingold.
This is the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Every week, we flip to a page from the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book, and we interview one of the contributors about their topic. We have a very good one this time around. We have Pietro Porcidelli. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome, welcome. This podcast, as you know, is all about the craft of game writing and how we go about this. And you have a particularly unique perspective, and I was wondering if you could start by sharing a bit about yourself, how you came into this field, and how you contribute to it on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and also for inviting me to write the short chapter in the book. I am a game designer, developer, and sometimes a writer for games. I work in OpenLab. We are a micro game development company of four partners. We are based in Florence in Italy, and we have been developing a lot of applied games since for about 12, 13 years in the field of games for health and many other fields. But since 2019, we have been publishing also commercial games. First football drama, then role drama, then Becoming Saint. And all these games, and also all the applied games, have a strong, let's say, narrative component to them. And we've been experimenting about the integration of narrative and mechanics in many different ways. Also, we have, like, our latest game is, and also the game we're developing now, Revolt of the Commons, they're strategy and tactical games. So these are not usually the kind of game where, let's say, the integration with narrative is the strongest point. But we have been working on that and experimenting on that. And I'll say that all our games have a strong part. And in fact, the very starting motivation for doing the game is a political commentary. And this is a very, let's say, the heart of the inspiration of what we do and what we have been developing. The tone generally that we use is somehow paradoxical and with humor, but the themes are usually not funny at all.
Thank you. That's a really, really good intro. It really gives us a sense of the roundedness of what you do. So the first question that we always ask for the podcast is for people to outline the essay that they did for the book and tell us the thesis of that essay. Now, that's a bit difficult in your case because your essay wasn't really an essay. It was a short story, which I completely loved. And I was very, very happy when I saw it come through the submission. It was called A Simple Pawn. So I think, rather than asking you to outline the thesis and to spoil what the point of what you were writing about was, because I feel like that's deliberately held back from the reader, could you just sort of briefly just tell us what was the story that you told us in that essay? What story did you want to tell?
So the story is about, without spoiling how it ends or what's, but the story is about a pawn. So the story is about, let's say, the last of the last. And in fact, the starting point, as it is the starting point of the last two games that we've been developing, is a reflection on how history is represented in games. So as you may be aware, historians have since quite a long time changed the way they do research and the core of the themes that in history and so history is not just as it is researched and developed and published today is not just a long list of kings and popes and queens and battles. It's not just a linear thing, but it's about how society evolves and how every member of the society lived and what were the ideals and this kind of thing. But then if you do, I don't know, if you go on Steam and research for history games, that's not exactly what you get. You get the usual, let's say, somehow colonialist, imperialist inspired kind of games. And I think in vast majority of cases, there's a perfect mirroring of kind of ideology, classical way of viewing history and the games that are produced. So this kind of reflection and kind of research that I did for the games inspired me to write this story from a different perspective. So, and also, you know, as a way to stimulate writers and game designers and narrative designers to consider the perspective of the story of any participant in the game that you're designing. So it can be very interesting to see, for example, the battle from the point of view of the last of the soldiers, not just from the point of view of the general, not just from the point of view of the story, maybe, but also I could suggest maybe from the point of view of control. And also this could lead you from this reflection to history, to this, so into this reflecting about what is the perspective on the narrative and what kind of story you want to tell. And this could even involve, as we know, narrative mechanics and the dynamics of it are always, and in games they should be all connected when it works. And so it could lead you to also reflect on the power relationship of control. So not just so in fact, often in games you either are one of the characters, usually it's a choice that makes sense, somehow the center of the pivot of the story. So in some games, like in games like Exploring the World, maybe you're the majordomo and not the main guy, and like in 80 Days, of course. And so again, in the story, maybe the player could have a role that is not just of the general, or which is often in history, strategic, tactical games, the player is often a god that acts with unlimited power from above, unlimited information, maybe not unlimited power from above. And that could be an interesting thing to question. Of course, it's not easy to question because the way games are made, the way this media is built, the very fact that you have the controller in your hand puts you at the center of action, which
in
is
control,
the fascination of the media. So it's not easy to somehow change or do some play there, but it's possible. And so this was this is why I took this indirect way of telling this, because there are many dimensions involved that can be kind of complex. So I thought if I get the reader to see things from this perspective, maybe it stimulates reflections of a more in a wide general spectrum of cases.
I absolutely love that, and I'm not even slightly surprised that the answer is complicated, rich, and hugely interesting, as opposed to just sort of, oh, it seemed like a good idea at the time. So I'm very, very glad that we started with that question. I thought there were two things that came out of that that were really, really spoke to me personally. And the first is the encouragement to game writers and designers to be thinking about the metaphor of what they're writing and how the metaphorical layer works upfront and immediately. And the second, as you dug into a little bit there, is that question of perspective and the perspective that the player has, what they know about the world, how they understand the world. And I think putting that into the context of games that are talking about history, that's incredibly interesting because, yeah, absolutely. The idea of history, are we looking at this thing in a top-down, let's state how it is kind of way? Are we trying to be experiential and say this is how it felt to people living in that time who might have had a completely different understanding of how the systems of the world worked than what was true or than, you know, what we understand to be true now? I guess I'm interested for you, as someone kind of writing and designing these things, about that idea of perspective. When you're thinking about the perspectives to give to a game, What do you find yourself drawn to? What are the things you're most interested in exploring in terms of the perspective that you give the player? Like, does it very much depend on the setting or the concept, or is there a particular form that you just enjoy or you think is more useful? Where do you lean?
Well, I must say that I must confess that I never start from the game. Game, or not even from the story. I always start from the theme, so from what I want to say. So, for example, when we talk about history, but if you look at the games that we did, like in the game of sports, I was, in the case in particular, was football. So I, for example, there, the theme was how surprised I was about how many football supporters are fascinated by this sport in a sort of a poetic perspective. So it's not a game as much about winning, losing, but it's more about the epic side of the thing. And in so many media, I saw that this kind of aspect and perspective had been taken in movies, in books, even in poetry. But so little had been done in games, where the simulation and performative side of the sport was a theme. So again, I started from this perspective. I started, it's kind of, from the very start, I look at the theme, I try to take a kind of different kind of perspective of what has been thematized, even though it's popular art, and which for me is a crucial thing that makes video games so much more interesting to work with, because you have not easy, but you do have access to an incredibly wide audience, and so maybe you can supply to this audience a kind of different angle, and that is like for example, how, I mean, absurd and corrupted, like the whole football FIFA structure has been in history, with the most amazing stories. Also, this kind of perspective also gives you always find there's no lack of stories if you take this kind of switch. Yeah. And I don't know, like the FBI chasing the president and he hiding in a Swiss skyscraper underground and making it to escape, or things like, I mean, really crazy things. Reality, of course, can, if you take this kind of outlook on reality, it can give you plenty of suggestions and stories. Or a completely different thing from the perspective, again, was finding out that becoming a saint is a career. And it's the only career, at least for what I know, that starts with your death. Yeah. So, I mean, this was really, I was at dinner with this historian and he started telling me how when you die, you start this career and you may succeed or fail. Yeah. And you can have an average career, and so you can, what in Italian is beato, I don't know how it is in English, but that's somehow not a complete success. Huh? You can be a local reverend, then beato, but if you really make it, and it can take centuries, you can become saint. Centuries, because basically people forget the horrible things you've done, and they sort of remember only the new ones, or a crucial case is Saint Francis, who was, if you look at his speeches, who was, of course, totally incompatible with the structure of the church of the
time. Incredibly radical for the time.
Incredibly radical, and also the history of how his writings were hidden and burned by the Franciscans, but not by the Dominicans, who didn't like the Franciscans.
He had favorite groups that he factionalized.
Yes,
with,
so the historians found the original writings of St. Francis in the Dominican libraries, but not in the Franciscan libraries, and so they could reconstruct his original thought. I mean, again, this kind of perspective, like on what is a career, but most importantly, what is society, and the fact like that in 14th century Italy, the first rise of financial capitalism induced a lot of class struggle, which then were just named as heretic movement, but it actually was a popular revolt and class struggle. And so talking about this theme through a game about becoming saint and creating your own heretical political movement, Again, these are the points where my different perspectives start from, and I can suggest, I think, that that if you study history, society in these kind of details and alternative perspective, this can suggest you a lot of very funny or interesting stories. Mm-hmm. And there is always a way to put together with mechanics. I mean, also the work, the design of how to integrate narrative and mechanics is extremely hard, complex, as you all know. But I don't think there are. You can express narrative through any kind of mechanics if you really work on it. And there are so many suggestions that can come even from the most unlikely kind of, even a match-free mechanics, I found even the most simple and somehow addictive and used for evil mechanics can become a great way to tell stories. And I've seen so many examples of this.
I completely agree. Yeah. John will detect that I'm chomping at the bit here because this is like one of my favorite topics in games, right? So I have been waiting for this interview, Pietro, because you have gone into using real history to fuel your thought process in a way you so beautifully outlined right here. And you anticipated my questions. I wanted to go into Fradolcino and Francis in more detail, and specifically Becoming Saints, because it's such a rare type of game that you see. And it's such an interesting angle to take for the very thematic point that you mentioned here, that the closer you zoom in on any section of history, the more you realize that this is not an alien country. These are people that had their own ups and downs and quirks. They might use different language to describe it. But if you can bring that to life for a modern audience, and as you say, it's a popular art form, games are, right? So if you can somehow humanize that to people now, suddenly it's like an entire vault door has opened for them that they're like, oh, I can understand this. This is incredibly moving or interesting or what have you. So I think Becoming Saint is just an extraordinary piece. And just in general, your overall approach reflected in this article you've written, but also in other articles you've done on your Substack and other places about having a non-hero centered approach to history and games, sort of seeing the different perspective. I wonder if you could expand a little bit more on the types of historical fiction that we see in the mass market for sort of historically themed games, and how a different tack would be. So let's say in Becoming Saint, why did you pick the perspective you did there? In a more mainstream historical game, what is it that we observe that maybe paints with too broad of a brush in some cases? How do you differentiate whether in your game you're able to achieve this or not?
I'm not sure I'm able to answer, but I'll try. So first of all, I would say that when I'm talking about history in games, I must say that mostly we're not talking about simulator games or games that somehow are accurate in some kind of perspective, but still there are perspective, and in their own way they can be accurate because we have multiple sources. There are many. I won't enter into historical methodology, but let's say that the fact that they're not accurate, I don't think it's a problem at all.
Yeah.
And in fact, they should be called, I think a historian suggested, pseudo-historical games. I think that's a good way to term. And in the case of Becoming Saint, while first of all, it's a microscopic production, basically developed by two guys, so in 2 years. So it's not,
it's very beautiful
that
for that.
Compare to anything done by like large strategic games companies, like. So the themes are a way to suggest some kind of switch perspective. So they don't, but they're all inspired that like in Becoming Saint, you have this 9 possible political orientation, and you take these choices. So there's a strong narrative part of branching choices in, for example, whether you want your followers to, they're allowed to have shoes or not. Okay, or they can eat animals or not.
Because you're creating a sort of heretical sect, right? That's the approach. So you're defining your rules.
The term sect is of course used by the
church,
dominating factor, but anybody else is a sect. And anyway,
yeah, that's right.
So for example, or like equality between males and females, which was one of the themes, like in particular, if one wants to check out a really extraordinary movement, is the Fra Dolcino movement of the time. If you read the Name of the Rose, again, he has this kind of approach, is more accurate, but still pseudo-historical. He takes pieces from manuscripts and the Bible and puts in the story, plays with it. The humor component is also very, very important.
You mean in Echo? Or
in Echo and yeah, in our game. And yeah. I don't know, but even strong inspirations are like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So, I mean, of course, the historical accuracy, it's not there, but in a way it is there. You know that they somehow have researched the theme. Okay?
Yeah.
But then the representation aim is to give a kind of message. It's not in the accuracy of the historical reconstruction. And but I want to add something to that. So when you check in, for example, how confrontation and power struggles were done, like in 14 centuries, like in the battles, for example, Saint Francis' first career was as a warrior. Okay, yep. But and the relationship with violence and death is not as we usually imagine. Like for example, the battles were not very deadly at all, and sometimes even nobody died, okay? Mostly people were captured and then asked a ransom for, like in the case of Francis. He was captured and then freed because he had a very, very rich father. So, for example, in becoming saint, the confrontations are not used through, violence or killing, but by, persuading the others, convincing the others, scaring the others somehow, but this is a real thing that was happening and it still happens in war. So again, that's another thing you can be inspired from, and the way they're presented in games, some often is not very original. But a big hurdle I've been thinking about and also working about is the notion of hero. So again, as I said before, I'm repeating myself in a way, but because of how games are built, it's very hard to somehow weaken or make it give an original perspective of a hero, or not having heroes at all. And the fact of having a god-like view, of course, is not fixing the problem, is maybe multiplying it. So for that, the notion, I think, of delegation of power, this is what I'm playing now in Revolt of the Commons, is something interesting. So to generalize this a bit for people working narrative design, again, just thinking about this theme is not so common. I mean, this media is the video games as a media is such a by now it's so incredibly widespread, powerful, cross-generational, but it does tend to be somehow repetitive and following very, very much some standards. And I, in my experience, it's very hard to because of how genre specific this industry is, and players are, and how little players generally tend to cross genres or kinds or platforms. I wasn't aware of this in the beginning, but in the years I found out that it's if you want to do something original, you have to balance it with somehow meeting, intersecting the taste of the genres and switching something, but not everything, because
that's the hardest challenge.
It's a high risk of not getting understood.
Yeah, I can really relate to that. I think I've heard it that same advice originally in just linear fiction, actually, when people would say, oh, it's if you want to introduce a new style or a new take or just a new idea, it's a good idea to write something that people think they understand first and then to twist it as you go. Mm. Because otherwise they simply won't look at it in the first place, which is extremely frustrating. But like, it's definitely, it feels on the other hand, like it's somehow a more interesting challenge in a way, maybe, because you can just come up with something completely new and revolutionary and different. But it's kind of harder again to come up with something revolutionary or different, yeah, and then find a way to build it into something that you can just give to people directly and they can understand. So I really respect that sort of thought process and that approach. I had one particular question about this idea of kind of disempowering the hero concept a little bit, because it's definitely something that we've played with at Inkle and that I'm sort of interested in, but it's very easy to fall back into accidentally making a hero just because the player is there and they need something
they
to
need
do.
To do something.
Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking, particularly in the context of history, because one way to explain the way that history goes is surely to say, well, it's quite arbitrary and quite random, actually. Like, some people just happen to survive and some people happen to die and some people happen to be successful. And, you know, that Isaac Asimov's idea of psychohistory that's all mapped out by these insurmountable forces. Like, that's one theory. And the other theory is anything could happen tomorrow. And I'm never sure I really know where I think the truth is. But do you find that that you have to kind of compromise the history that you want to tell in order to make it feel fair to the player, to kind of, or do you find that there, if you take the right approach, you can systematize things in a way that feels like you're representing the truth as you see it or some kind of reality while still giving the player a set of rules they can understand and they can make predictions and they can work with? It isn't just something crazy happens every 5 minutes and the player is just going, well, I don't know. Like, do you find that's a compromise you have to make actively? Does it just fall out of the design? How do you tackle that?
No, this has been, and in fact has been, probably my main struggle. I'm very surprised, John, that you asked such a smart, brilliant question.
I'm so surprised. Do you hear that, John? Yeah. I'm surprised.
Seriously, we've done a lot of podcasts. I've got a hit rate of about 1 in 10 with my questions. Oh,
I had to tease you at least once in the podcast. So anyway.
I will take it, sir.
But yeah, so basically my tendency, this comes from the way I was writing short stories before the game, so is to just go wild and crazy, one thing after the other, and somehow bring my idea of a story is like of a feverish dream where things are happening one after the other and you sort of understand them, but to hint at a million others and give you, and this is the whole experience. And a bit football drama, the first game I wrote, the first commercial game, is a bit like that. And I think the game did well, even if I was doing that, because of so many people really love the crazy side of football and so on. But right, in my experience, this is definitely not a good idea to how to build your game. This is so, players in particular, Steam players, maybe mobile players are a bit different, but they really want to understand everything that's happening. So yeah, this is basically the very opposite of what I tried to do in my game. So it's a constant struggle. It's a constant struggle. And in fact, the game I'm doing now is the first deterministic where full information is given from the start to the end. It's been for me very interesting learning experience, because in strategy, I'd even tried to do that with Becoming Saint, even in strategy game, and they took it basically as a personal offense, the fact that I'm trying to violate the basic laws of the genre. And so yes, this is a very interesting thing. And you have to somehow be fair to the player. That's very important. So if people come in from other media, or I think they will often struggle with that. Mm. And another thing, it's not directly related, but I, in my experience, if you're a writer in short stories, novels, or I don't know, movies, series and things, adapting, moving to games. There's so the process of adaptation from one genre to the other. There's a lot of work to be done and struggle. And in fact, I have in the last 3-4 years, as many other people I found out on this podcast, have been moved into theater. And it had to come up somehow.
Yeah.
And I've been doing working with a Swiss theatrical company. They do performative theater. It's
really?
mostly research theater is since the 70s, actually. But anyway, so we've been integrating kind of board games in the performance so that anybody can join. And I was surprised how much experience in video game narrative design can somehow be used and be useful in using in other media. So this is something I encourage people very much. I mean, I've been working with museums and a lot of these kind of things. And it's also a nice way to enter the field. If you want to enter it from, let's say, not just building stairs in a AAA studio, which is fine too, of course, so moving to theater also was extremely stimulating, interesting, and there too, there's a struggle. You have basically 1.5 hours at most to transmit the whole experience, not 30 days of gameplay with the trial and error as it is allowed in games. So, and also most of the large majority of people that come to the theater are people that that hate games or never played one.
It's a different audience for sure.
Yeah, it's a can be a very different audience. And so the way to make mechanics inclusive of a wide spectrum of people there, it's extremely interesting. And the ways to tell a story, again, as in video games, music, lights, settings, but also live interaction with people. And there's so much that ports. Sometimes at the very start, you need to, when you're moving to another media, is to understand the local dialect, the notion of narrative designer, the notion of dramaturg, what exactly is a dramaturg, and which also depends on the theater school, whether it's from Germany, which mostly are, or not, and so on. So just to understand what are the roles. And also it's interesting to work in a media which in a way is way more mature than video games. So for example, I don't know, like that I discovered things amazing, like that the theater season, at least but most in all theater, they rewrite every piece that they perform is rewritten from start to end, adapting it to what they're doing. So yes, we're doing Hamlet, but actually what they're actually doing is a complete rewrite of the original piece and so on. And this, they do this for the whole season, and it's a huge amount of work and so specialized. But a lot ports. I had the same experience when I tried to design the first board games for video games. I thought, oh, this is going to be completely different because of course there's no algorithm, nothing computing results and so on. It is harder in a way, but there's also a lot that ports. So so I think if you a bit learn the skill of integrating narrative and mechanics, you can do a lot of work in other media too.
I love listening to that because I think a theme that comes through in a lot of what you say is just your own kind of openness to what you're working with. Like when you were describing how you set up projects, it's very much kind of you come up with a theme and you're quite open to where those mechanics will take you. And then if you enter theatre, you're kind of quite open to learning the language and the mechanisms of that environment. I just think that's quite an inspiring position, actually, because I think a lot of people, you know, when they're thinking about narrative for games, they start with, I am going to make a card battler and I'm going to put a narrative on my card battler. So what kind of narrative can sit on a card battler without falling off? And obviously then you end up with this pyramid of designs that kind of gets narrower and narrower as it goes. Yeah, exactly. And we see a lot of the same things over and over. And I love that kind of openness both to the mechanics that come and go and the perspectives that come and go, but also to the medium itself. I think that's really, I really like that. I really respect that.
Yeah. I was going to say something very similar. I cannot, Pietro, you are so prolific. You are so open to all these different things and you produce such a volume of work. I admire it so much. I wish I could be doing something similar or learning as widely as you seem to be. We've talked a couple times and you yourself have mentioned the design component of some of these. I wonder if we can zoom in on that a little bit. So if you start with a theme, and by the way, I'm very sympathetic because I think I prefer that too. I've tended to work for projects that have a little bit more of a commercial imperative. And so we are often trying to work out like, well, what's the parallel genre that we can work with? What's the existing audience that we can push? But as just like a personal writer, narrative designer, those are the things I prefer. It's like these really out there, outlandish themes. And I wonder if you can help us think through your way of testing out a mechanic. The narrative design question more than the writing question, so to speak. Like you have a theme. Maybe that theme is the incredible number of stories behind a football organization. Maybe it's from Rome City of Cards and this project you're developing, right? And how you know which section of society you wished to zoom into. Maybe it's about, you know, building an alternate faith, like in Becoming Saints, right? Do you go through an experimental process where you're like, let's try this? Do you start to feel like, oh, this is a good fit for this mechanical genre? Of course, you also will have to work with the skills you have, I suppose, and what you think you can bring to life. What's that process? You're sitting at your table, you've sort of worked out, I have a cool theme. What happens next?
So let's say there is what would be nice. What would be nice to happen and what actually happens. So and all this is made harder by the nature of our medium. Okay. And what I mean by that? I mean that a big problem to see is you see whether a game is working, so to say, a game idea, is that a lot needs to be done to be done before you see whether it works.
Yeah, assess whether it's yes, working. You need to do work
exactly,
in advance. Yeah.
Exactly. So this is a huge problem. This is a big deal for small studios, of course. I mean, small studios that are not just burning money. But actually, the capacity of games as a media to burn through money is such, and it's basically unbounded.
Yeah,
so this
forever,
is this is interesting thing. You can basically with any kind of game you can burn any kind of amount of money if you want to, because there's no end. It's a craftsmanship, so there's no end to the amount of beautiful details that you can go in anything that you're doing. Okay, so this is another. It's an incredible skill of this field. So you can have a huge amount of money, but still you can get nowhere because the field can burn through anything.
It's extraordinary.
Produce nothing. Yeah. So one thing that I learned that can somehow mitigate this kind of problem I'll say a prohibited word, the fun of the game. Okay. So fun can come as the very last thing. And this was very surprising to me. Very surprising to me. My suggestion is to evaluate once you got to a game loop, which unfortunately is already a lot of effort, but without it, it's very hard to judge whether your game works or not. So you have to get to somehow a game loop. So my method is, of course, through feedback testing. So and there are many ways to get to a loop without even going into the game engine somehow. There are many tools, one produced by our friend here, but to test, like, for example, narrative parameters, mechanics, whether the whole thing somehow runs, okay? But then with integration with mechanics, you have to go through probably some form of game engine or paper simulation or board game. There are many ways to somehow make it possible to reach a feedback end game loop. But the world without testing and without having the courage to somehow kill No, I won't say it because you don't, John doesn't like it, but to somehow change your ideas, to somehow radically change your ideas through it. Games absolutely need that because the minimum level of quality that it's required is very high. So without testing, ideas are not sad to say, but ideas are worth cheap. Very, very, very little. And every game designer has ideas all the time, and most of it won't work. And it's not the ideas that make the thing work. It's the idea immersed with all the other dimensions and so on. But I was surprised how once a mechanics somehow smoothly works, you see the feed, the parameters somehow work. The fact of making it enjoyable for the player, if it's working well, that mostly goes into effects, animation, things, funny things you can add. And somehow something that can seem very boring can actually be great fun. But the other also, and even more the other way around, unfortunately,
no, so it's true.
I gave a very messy answer, but
this is exactly right.
I think one thing I like about that is the kind of corollary, the side effect of it, which is that you can make a game that's as beautiful and as polished and as effects and as juicy as you like, but if that core game loop isn't working, people always notice. notice. They never fail to spot that. And I think there's a tendency. There can be a tendency for people to go, this game design is good enough. We need to get on and make this thing because it's so expensive. And that, especially that iteration phase, can feel like you're throwing money in the bin if you happen not to be hitting ideas that really work. But it's very much a fool's errand if you set off on a design which doesn't work. And I think that's important to draw out what you were saying.
Go ahead.
Yes, John, let me add one thing, because I think this is very important, the fact that you said they noticed. They notice. Okay. So even if you have, this is also people come from, maybe from writing can think about it. You can have the most beautifully written story, beautiful context, beautiful graphics, beautiful sounds. Okay. The problem is that people don't play your story, don't play your audio, don't play your graphics. They play the experience of this. That running through, and you can have a very bad story. Sad to say, you have quite a bad story and very ugly graphics, and it can still be a good game. So maybe not the best game of all times, but it can still be a good experience to go through it. Mm-hmm. So you should start from a very, let's say, humble position there. The quality of your contents does not determine the quality of the experience of your contents.
It's the sum of all of those things somehow. Like, it's like every little piece together. And I guess I wonder, like, you do, if you do testing, and I've done a bunch of testing too, does that not push the question down the road just a little bit? Because there's so many ways to go wrong with the testing too, right? You could be getting the wrong people to test, so to speak, people who never would have been the audience of the game. How do you manage that? In fact, have developed a tool for this, right? Like, so Homer is like a way that you've done to quickly test some things out.
Yes.
Tell us about how you manage that problem.
Well, I don't actually manage it, but so testing, you have to learn to test. So again, that's not obvious. Because when you give a game to test, you're either getting insincere feedback if you even remotely know the person who's playing it, which is not very useful, or you're getting competent feedback, which is what I get. So if you go and just put a game out and people give you written feedback or things like this, mostly things are not very useful, okay, by themselves. But go like on a show and watch people playing your game, okay? It's not what they tell you afterwards. It's what you see, the enormous, huge, and infinite amount of mistakes that you'll see in your game when you see people playing your game. That is a great way to test it. And but also actually all the textual or live feed that they give you often is not, don't take literally what they're saying, but they're referring to stuff that you need to fix. So So testing, and again, it's extremely important and it's crucial, and you have to test with, not with friends, unless, of course, if you have quite expert game designer friends, they will give you a different kind of feedback, okay, on the structure, on the mechanics, on some limit cases, or some standards of the genre, very important, standard of the genre you're violating. Maybe you should, or if you do it, you should do it consciously, not because you don't know about it, and things like this. So there are many, many sources of feedback. You have to, again, you have to be ready to change.
Yeah, I tend to avoid getting game designers to test our games because they always start redesigning the game, I find.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I wouldn't do it this way. I would do this. And you go, well, that's nice, but that's not what we're doing. But I did want to say, I remember very vividly one piece of show testing, because show testing, it can be expensive to get into a show sometimes, but it can be incredibly useful, that we took Heaven's Vault, when we were working on Heaven's Vault, we took it to Comic-Con one year, and there were these two teenagers who sat down to play Heaven's Vault, and we were standing right there, and one of them played for about 3-4 minutes and then turned to his friend and, literally looking straight past me, just said, "This game is so bad," to his friend. "It's one of the worst things I've ever played." And then off they went, and we were like, and then after they left, we were quite happy because the buttons had all worked. He'd driven the character fine. He'd interacted with all the things, like all the tutorialization had worked. And like, yeah, he didn't like the game at all, but like, he absolutely did not get stuck on it. And we were like, brilliant, this is working. And it was just the weirdest gap between the sort of notional. And, you know, if that feedback had been like, I sent them a build, they send me back a message, I would have been devastated. But actually watching them play, that was great.
You learned something, yeah. We had something similar for Helldivers too. We did all this formal testing through Sony, where we brought people into a lab, we got to see what they were doing, and we would interview them, of course. But none of that was as useful as like trying to, we had even eye trackers, we could see everything they were up to. And that was very, very helpful, that because you'll get written feedback afterwards, which can sometimes be helpful because some people don't emote. So you can't tell what they're feeling, or maybe they emote in a way that you are just not good at reading. But if you're watching their screen and you're seeing, oh, they're sort of walking to a place, not realizing they can sprint or something, you learn very, very quickly, like, oh, maybe we need to tutorialize this a bit better, or what have you.
Yeah, and all this is influenced, I must mention this, by money, in the sense that it's all good, but for example, in our latest game, we had a publisher. So we had a publisher and we got professional testing feedback periodically with reports and so on. And this can improve your development cycle enormously. So again, it's, you can burn through it if you have a lot, but you have a little, you have to find economic ways of getting your game tested, because it can really make a big difference. But of course, it depends on your resources. And this, to me, I just want to add one thing about what we said, what you said previously about me being open to different kind of works. Again, this is something I, for people starting in the field, we all know that there are way more graduate in game design, in game writing, and game development, I think, now, than there are jobs in the industry. So so the fact of I go in games only because I want to be the character writer for Grand Theft Auto. Yeah, okay, there are some places, in some friends actually in Edinburgh doing that, but probably it's very hard to get into that at the moment in particular, because they're about to ship probably sooner or later or ever. And anyway, who knows?
But just to be clear, we don't.
We don't know.
We don't know.
Don't chase us.
No, I didn't get any hint. No.
Anyway, carry on.
but still, the skill set that you acquire in this field, which is, I have worked in software in many other fields many years before games. The skill set that is required in games is incredibly high, high. If you're working in, I don't know, pharma or steel industries or things, software development is so much easier than in games. And basically anything else is easier. So the level of skills that you're acquiring, if you don't have precondition, you're not closed. If you get any opportunity of doing some kind of writing, interactive writing for the most diverse kind, I wrote a game on safety on oil extraction platforms, or the most bizarre things. They can come, but they can be a great opportunity to build the experience, learn, and for sure you're not wasting your time or energy there.
Yeah, and I meet increasingly many writers who are working in educational contexts, enterprise contexts, healthcare contexts, education in schools, doing game development, and it's clearly, I think it's growing as a sector. So it's very much a real part of the job. Pietro, we've been talking for a long time. It's been absolutely brilliant. I love your perspective. I love the work that you do. I think it's really fascinating, and it's so great to get a kind of a really intellectually and artistically grounded practitioner onto the podcast to kind of balance off against the kind of industry grounded people and the freelancers we have. I love the spectrum of people that are working in this industry and all the various different directions we're pulling it in. But we must come to a close because we have reached the time. So I'm just going to say thank you very much again for joining us. It's been absolutely superb. Listeners, please join us again next week when we will interview someone completely different. And thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.